you will increase your efficiency 20% if you learn to do the tough things first, the ones you don't want to do.
Ray Zinn now imparts his management philosophy in Tough Things First. In this series, Zinn covers it all, from the essence of human happiness.
If you're going to make it a consistent practice of working Saturdays just because you think you've got to work 80 hours a week to be successful, you're just flat out wrong.
To the downside of venture capital.
Well, I guarantee if you don't sweat the small things, the big things are going to become a mess.
And the essence of entrepreneurial discipline.
Don't want to wait until you jump off the cliff to grab a parachute.
Now here's Ray Zinn, Silicon Valley's longest serving CEO and today's guest host.
Hello again, and welcome to another episode of the Tough Things First podcast, where we engage Ray Zinn, the longest serving CEO in all of Silicon Valley. And we talk about entrepreneurship, leadership, executive management, and a little bit about society and how we all get along in life. But today, we're going to have, I think, one of the more interesting topics for my mind, and that's the art of decision-making for entrepreneurs. Because in my time in Silicon Valley and nurturing a lot of startups myself, I have seen entrepreneurs absolutely lock their brains in trying to make some fundamental decisions. And Ray, he doesn't seem to have a lot of problems with making quality decisions quickly. So we're going to figure out how he does it. So good morning, Ray. Welcome again. Thank you so much for taking time with us.
Well, thank you, Guy. Good to be back with you today.
An entrepreneur, somebody launching their own business, they have to make thousands of decisions. I mean, that's pretty much their job, is to make a lot of decisions, make them quickly, make them with a certain amount of quality. And yet a lot of guys and a lot of women, they kind of freeze up, especially on some of the big decisions. So what is it that causes people to freeze and not make the decisions that they need to make?
Well, Tom Peters, in his book, In Pursuit of Excellence, talks about ready, aim, and never fire. And so what we need to do is Tom says in his book, is ready, fire, aim. That seems kind of counterintuitive. But back in the days when we had the battleships and the destroyers, they would fire for effect. In other words, you would shoot a round off and see where it went high or low. And, you know, the gunnery officers would say, oh, you're 20 feet high or you're 30 feet low or something. And so, you know, you adjust your aim. So it's ready, fire, aim, in that sense. You know, would you fire for effect and then see. So, don't be afraid to make a decision, because, you know, you're going to be adjusting it. So part of the decision making process is to say, here's the objective. Here's what I want to accomplish. Okay. So then you go ahead and you start executing on that decision. And then if it doesn't work out like you want, you revise it and you back to the front again, back to the top. It's a circle. And so being able to do that ready, fire, aim is very important when making good decisions. You know, you don't step off the cliff and say, oh, now I need a parachute. You have to have, you know, you start out by saying, okay, what do I want to accomplish? What's my goal? And then you set a plan. You say, okay, my first step is to do this. If that first step doesn't work, you revise it, come back to the beginning again. Then you change your process and go forward. Now, in my case, I like to have some standards. Here's conditions that I will not go beyond. So that when time comes to make that decision, I don't have to decide. I've already decided in advance. For example, we had a policy at Micrel of having 90 days worth of working capital in place at all times. In other words, 3 months. I made sure that I looked at my balance. I call it my business savings account. I looked at that savings account and I said, okay, do I have 3 months worth of operating capital? And I wouldn't spend more money. I wouldn't increase my cost or my expenses until I had my 3 months of that working capital in place. And then we would look at which way the revenue is moving up or down and then adjust our working capital needs based on whether the business was going up or down. So again, having this business savings account was critical at Micrel, and we always had at least 90 days worth of working capital In fact, at the end, we had actually 1 year's worth of working capital in our savings account.
Well, and to take some of what you said, phrasing it slightly differently, it's easier to modify and improve a 50% good decision that you made quickly than it is to come up with a perfect decision, because making the perfect decision will just take way too long.
Mm-hmm. Analysis.
How does an entrepreneur kind of get over that emotional edge of making more rapid decisions, imperfect as they may be? What is the psychological barrier that keeps people from shifting to that mode of making imperfect but expedient decisions?
Well, that's called zigging when you should have zagged. You know, so you know, if you know what you want, in other words, if you have a goal in mind and what type of people you're going to hire or what kind of job product you're going to make, and so you have those goals well set in advance, then when it comes time to make the decision, you're not stumbling over it. You move forward with confidence. There's no perfect decision. All decisions have risk, and then you have to measure the amount of risk to how you go ahead and execute on that particular decision. As you just said, you know, rather than jumping off a cliff, you know, maybe you say, okay, what do I want to do here? What's my objective? Do I want to do a free fall for a ways and then pull a chute, or, you know, what, or do I just want to jump off a 5 foot? You don't need a parachute if you're jumping off a 5 foot amount. So, you know, you just have to measure what it is it takes to execute on that decision. And then, you know, make sure you have in place all the requisite, things that are necessary for you to make a good decision or make the decision successful.
Well, you know, it's interesting that you phrased it that way. General Colin Powell, he was once quoted as saying that when he was making big decisions, he would study the problem until he had studied it about 65% of everything he would need to study in order to make a perfect decision, and then go with the gut.
Uh-huh.
And what you had said earlier was that there were certain parameters, such as having 3 quarters of operating or 3 months of operating capital on hand, as one of the rules that was in that 65% of what you needed to make a great decision. So I think the two dovetail together really nicely, getting some of those fundamentals pre-decided and having that be part of your framework of the 65%. That you need before you make a business decision.
Exactly. In other words, if you sit down and say, okay, here's what I want to accomplish, all these different parameters, 4 or 5 is typical, and say, here's my inviolate rules that I'm not going to violate. So then you measure your decision against that, your 5 inviolate parameters, and then it helps you make that decision. For example, coming up with the right product. If you say, okay, I'm going to be in the banking business, then of course you weren't going to go into real estate as you would. You know, you stay in the banking side. If, however, you're in real estate, vice versa, you're not going to try to go into become a banker. I have a friend who has an airline, a little small airline company, and he said, you know, how do I get my my customers from making me the bank? And I said, well, then you can't, you don't act like a bank. You don't stretch out, you know, their receivables, or let them stretch out the receivables so that you become a bank, because you will become a bank if you don't have these rules set down as to how you're going to handle these debts that are moving out. You know, they become bad debts pretty soon. So, you know, you don't let your customers or don't let your environment push you into becoming something you don't want to become. And so, you know, if you're a bank, act like a bank. If you're running a retail business, you know, don't let your customers make you become a bank, because you're not going to be a very good banker. And so, you know, that's kind of a crude way of making it, the comparison, but that's the way you do it. Don't have these parameters set up so that you, when you come time to make a decision, that you won't violate the basic parameters of your company.
Well, and this kind of gets into parameter setting for the organization and decisions, once an entrepreneur grows their business, you know, at all, they have to start delegating. They have to start giving some decision responsibility to other people in the company. So how does an entrepreneur migrate this skill to the entire organization? How does he or she get everyone in the company to make better, faster decisions if they are not blessed with the entrepreneurial drive that the leader has?
Well, it's back to monkey see, monkey do, you know. So, you know, if you are setting the bad example of decision making, they're going to follow. So, you know, if you have these parameters defined, okay, we won't violate these parameters, then that gets migrated onto to your staff, to your employees. Then they're more likely to make the good decisions, so that you don't have to make them for them. So, or micromanage them, as they say. So again, a monkey see, monkey do. You know, set the right example. You set the parameters. You say, here's the things we will not violate. This is sacrosanct. This is what we will be and say who we'll be, and we won't violate that. Then, of course, better decisions will be made.
Well, and I think there's also an opportunity in terms of teaching the process. I remember you telling me a story once about you had a redundant fabrication facility. You had already decided in your mind that it probably needed to be shut down. And if I remember correctly, it was your CFO who kind of agreed with that, but for the wrong reasons. And you kept stalling the decision until he thought it through completely. Can you tell us that story and how that was a teaching moment for him in terms of how to correctly evaluate this decision?
If you're referring to when we had to shut down a fab, wafer fab, it was back in 2003. You know, to shut the fab down was going to violate one of the principles of always being profitable. And so it was, you know, we're going to be darned if we do and darned if we don't. So if we shut the fab down, it's going to cause us to go into a loss position. If we don't shut the fab down, we're just going to keep, you know, hurting our bottom line. We'll make money, but it'll affect our bottom line for years to come, probably 3 or 4 or 5 years. So, you know, sometimes you have to eat the ugly frog. And finally, I decided, well, you know, we may have to violate one of our basic parameters of always being profitable. So we had to give up that one goal for that ability to be able to close that fab down and take that write-off of that closing against earnings. But then it helped our earnings going forward. So, you know, it's darned if you do, darned if you don't. You know, you're going to violate one of your basic parameters. And we did argue and fight about that for some time before we decided to go ahead and shut it down. So, you know, in the final analysis, we did close it down, and we did lose money, a small amount of money, but it also they found ways of reducing the loss by minimizing the impact to the company, which was good. So, you know, it would have been like 3 or 4 times the loss that we had we not at least tried to minimize that loss as we were shutting the facility down.
And for people who have not read Ray's books, Ray had one unprofitable year in 37. This was the year in question. If I remember correctly, the total loss for that year was about $50,000, which for a publicly traded semiconductor company is, you know, chicken scratch. Mm-hmm. And so that gives you a little bit of an idea about the nature of quality decisions and making decisions at a good pace, because it is this kind of formula that allowed Ray to be in business and to be consistently profitable for 36 out of 37 years. And if you're an entrepreneur or if you're an executive and you want that kind of success, go to Amazon.com right now, get a copy of Tough Things First, because this is the new Silicon Valley Bible for how one goes about creating an enduring business that's going to last the generations, that's going to be consistently profitable, and which is going to do so in no small part because the employees within inside the organization are satisfied Ray's company had the lowest employee turnover rate within sight of his industry, and that was part of the profitability success. And you'll learn about that and other facets of management leadership with inside of the book, Tough Things First.
While you're talking about the value of the book, there's a common acquaintance of ours, guy that told us recently that had he had this book, Tough Things First, back when he started his company many, many years ago, he wouldn't have had to declare bankruptcy, he said, because he would have set the right parameters and goals for his company, and they would not have gone bankrupt. So he was very, very fanatical about it. He said, boy, I wish every new entrepreneur could read this book, Tough Things First. Oh, this would save so many companies from going out of business. And you know who I'm talking about, right, Guy, without mentioning his name?
Yes, I do. Yes, I do.
You know, the book has value in helping companies stay in business and stay profitable. So,
well, and one of the things that I do, and this is just exposing a little bit of myself, I work with a lot of academic institutions. They're centers for entrepreneurship, and I have been handing a copy of your book to a lot of people. In fact, I will be meeting with a school here locally where I live tomorrow, and I will be handing off the book. And I'm getting the same reaction with all of these academic institutions who are catering to entrepreneurs who have entrepreneurships centers. They read this book and they go, if this doesn't make our students more successful, then there's nothing else out there that we can feed them that will make them more successful. Their academia is seeing Tough Things First as a new critical resource. And I think that's a heck of an endorsement, because these universities are charged with making these student entrepreneurs successful right from the start.
Yeah, and they had a look into ZenStarter, which is on our website, toughthingsfirst.com. They can look a little bit more about ZenStarter and how we're helping universities reduce the failure rate of new startups. So
absolutely, they should. And for everyone in the audience, since we've already plugged the book, one other thing that I would like to ask a favor of you is rate and review this podcast, whether you're on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, doesn't matter. Just click the button, give it your rating, and by all means, mention it to your friends. The word of mouth is how podcasts are most frequently adopted by new listeners. So by all means, mention it to your friends and tune in again next week for yet another episode of Tough Things First.
And also get a copy of our book, Zen of Zen, Z-E-N of Z-I-N-N. You'll find it very, very helpful. And you know, whether you're a teacher or a dentist or our mother or, entrepreneur, it will help you as you go through your life, give you ideas and thoughts about how you can improve.
You've been listening to Tough Things First, candid talk with Silicon Valley's longest-serving CEO, Ray Zinn. Drop by the contact page at toughthingsfirst.com for more about the book, more podcasts, and links to Ray's Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn pages to keep up with Ray Zinn's wisdom daily.